This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Hey, I'm Francis Lamb. I'm the host of The Splendid Table, and I'm also the editor-in-chief at Clarkson Potter.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen.
Thank you so much, Francis, for agreeing to come on the podcast. I had such a wonderful time with you at the Splendid Table event in Orange County just recently. So I thought I'd...
That was great. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, you've steadily broken into the mainstream over the last decade, and you've won so many awards, the James Beard. And I've asked you on the podcast so we can get a glimpse of sort of your trajectory. And my young listeners are curious about, you know, coming into the mainstream, whether it be in food or film or all of these other career paths. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on, you know, sort of you landing in the mainstream space.
Well, it's funny because I'm, thank you for saying that. And thanks for having me on the show. I mean, I think to get back to like how I started first writing about food, because that was my first foray in media, was as a food writer. It was honestly, I sometimes have trouble when I'm talking to younger writers or folks who are, you know, thinking, how do I break into this industry, in the food media industry, or writing and journalism in general. And I have trouble with it because I have to be very honest, and I think that my own story was really kind of the product of luck, timing, and circumstance. And I don't say that with like, you know, false modesty. Like, I think, you know, I certainly have worked hard and I think I have a, you know, some level of skill anyway, but I think so much of my ability to sort of take that first step, which obviously in a lot of ways is the most important step, was because of just luck and timing. So I'll tell you the story first. And then we can get into what we can sort of take from it today in very different circumstances. So I was in culinary school in 2002-2003. And, you know, that was a very different time. Like, yeah. You know, over 20 years ago, right? So obviously decades. But also when we think about where our sort of mainstream pop culture was in terms of food, really different. You know, the Food Network had been sort of around for about a decade at that time. I remember when the Food Network started. I remember like watching it, and it was very, very different than what it is today. You know, it was a lot more, there was a show where it was literally two people sitting around a table right. talking about restaurant meals. It was like a restaurant critic show. And, you know, then there were like the shows that, you know, Emeril and Two Hot Tamales, it was like chefs standing and cooking. And Emeril actually really, I think, advance the form, I guess, by turning it into almost like a talk show style where people were in the audience and laughing at his jokes and smelling the food and oohing and aahing and really turning food into an entertainment. And so that had been percolating for about a decade and slowly was growing in popularity. And then you have to remember, like, Tony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential came out in like 2000. So that, I think, was a huge turning point in terms of the culture, you know, whatever you mean by that, but just like mainstream right. pop culture, thinking about chefs as interesting people. You know, prior to that, we didn't really do that.
Right.
Like, chefs were just like
normal people.
It's just another job, you know?
Yeah.
But Tony made it look like this exciting, fast, hardcore, wild sort of bad boy lifestyle, which, you know, he later apologized for. He was like, I think I've really perpetuated all these like misogynistic, you know, and other abusive sort of tendencies in our industry because I helped popularize that idea. But like that was happening in that moment. So anyway, so I was in culinary school in that time. And I was so excited to be there. I had like the beginning of a career before that in a totally different field. I was working in nonprofits and social justice, but I was psyched to be in culinary school. And I started just writing emails to friends and family about what I was learning, what life was like. And yeah, this was sort of at a time when there were lots of people who were starting to kind of fantasize about quitting your job and going to cooking school. And I just happened to do it 24 minutes before the next person did. So I was writing these emails to my friends and family. They started forwarding them around to each other. And one of my friends, who I went to college with, was working at a newspaper, the Financial Times. She sat next to the woman who was the editor of their weekend section where they run like lifestyle stories and stuff. And halfway through my program, I got a phone call from that editor saying, hey, your friend has been sending me these emails. They're a lot of fun. Would you want to write something for us about, you know, being in culinary school? So I did that. They had a great time with it. They made it this huge, like, multi-page spread, the full, you know, front page of the weekend section that week. It was crazy. I remember going to the newsstand and buying like five of them and be like, oh my God, like pictures of me that they sent a photographer to take a picture of me in cooking school, like in class and stuff. So that was kind of my start. So already a stroke of dumb luck. I was continued to write for them for a little bit. I eventually ran into Ruth Reichel, who was the editor-in-chief at Gourmet magazine at the time. You know, some of your older listeners will remember Gourmet, and your younger ones might not, because Gourmet eventually closed in 2009. But for those who don't know, Gourmet was kind of like the premier sort of high-end food magazine in the country, but it was under the editorship at that time, Ruth Reichel, who was sort of known as the woman who, you know, redemocratized the New York Times restaurant critic role. She famously, you know, when she was a hippie, like she straight up, like she came out of Berkeley. And when she, you know, she had a long career before becoming the New York Times restaurant critic. But when she got there, one of her things that she did was like start reviewing restaurants that weren't like high-end French and Italian restaurants. She went to an amazing, like beautiful, handcrafted soba restaurant in Soho and gave it 3 stars. And famously, the person who was a critic before her, like, wrote a letter to her boss being like, she's ruining the system that we created. What are you doing? A noodle shop in Soho getting 3 stars. So she was kind of known as this democratizing force in high-end food. And Gourmet, while obviously was geared towards like affluent readers, was a place that was interested in having, you know, stories that weren't just about the elite. And I ran into her, eventually started writing for that magazine. And my beat for the magazine kind of became, hey, I know you have all these amazing writers in Paris. You have these amazing writers who fly around the world. Like, I want to write about a Cantonese barbecue master in the suburbs of Toronto. I want to write about, you know, things more like that. And to me, it was this amazing way of having a reason to knock on someone's door and peek into their life and have them welcome me into their life and get their story. But for the magazine, that seemed interesting and new to them at the time. You know what I mean? Like, again, have to remember, this is 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So food culture was very different.
This no was, social media.
Yeah, there was no social media, like literally, like Instagram didn't exist. Twitter didn't exist. Although Twitter had just started, I think, when I was writing for Gourmet. So that's kind of how I got my start. And, you know, now it's like, there aren't magazines that will like pay thousands of dollars for you to fly to, you know, I had a story that I reported where I went back to my grandfather's home village in China, like, which I had never seen. Because I wanted to sort of retrace his steps, you know, I rang up thousands of dollars in expenses for that story, you know, So it's a little bit hard for me to tell my story now in the spirit of how does one break in now? Because I think it is very different. It's not the chance meeting with the gatekeeper that is really a most likely path for most people.
And the food ecosystem is saturated with people who are going back to their home countries on their own dime, creating video clips of getting reacquainted or getting acquainted with their food world from their mother country. And it's just normal now to see it all over. So yeah, that idea of like dumb luck and timing is, you know, it's just really, it's fascinating to hear these journeys that, you know, like pioneers, you're really like the pioneer in the early days of showing, you know, ethnic cuisine.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, look, it was about the context, right? The context was I was writing for this magazine that had this outsized voice in American food culture, and primarily their subject matter was high-end dining. I mean, to be fair, like, I was not like the first person to like write about someone who was not,
right,
you know, Alain Ducasse, like by no stretch of the imagination. But I think they saw in me a younger voice, a fresher voice. You know, they didn't have that many like rookie writers, you know, so they definitely took a chance on me, and I really, you know, will go to my grave appreciating it. But it was also a different time because like not everyone their mother wanted to be a food writer and not everyone their mother could start a blog and, you know, just make themselves a food writer. Didn't have to wait for someone to anoint them a food writer. You know what I mean? So now it's a very different thing. The one thing I would say that does carry over, and, you know, I'm an editor now. I edit other people's work. So I by no means think that I am like this, like amazing, like, you know, this like legendary writer, because I see what legendary writing looks like all the time. But I think I'm a pretty good writer. And I think what I really cared about was not just the craft of the language and the craft of the words and finding that one phrase or finding that one description that really draws you in, although I care about all those things. What I really, really cared about when I was writing my stories was how it got the story.
Mm.
And by that I mean, like, none of the stories I've ever written were my creations. They were all stories that I received. They were all stories that I was given for the most part. And so when I'm interviewing with someone, I'm talking to someone, they're taking time out of their day. They're taking time out of their lives. So their time is already a gift to me. And they're trusting me with their story. They're telling me something about their lives, about how they see the world, about their family, about their relationships, about why they care so much about what they cook or whatever. To bring it back to that Cantonese barbecue master story, you know, I wanted to learn his technique. I spent a week with him in his shop because I wanted to learn how he got that skin so bubbly and crisp. It was almost like he fried the skin of the pig when he did the whole pig, right? It was like one of those, he was just an amazing craftsperson. So I wanted to learn about his craft. But in that 5 days I spent cooking with him in his shop, you know, we'd stand around a lot. So we were talking. And while we were talking, he told me how he learned to cook, which was he escaped from China to Hong Kong. He swam. He was like a freedom swimmer. So almost lost his life by himself, made it, no money, no possessions, found himself in a restaurant, like offered to scrub the kitchen, and, you know, was the kid you'd like abuse in that kitchen, you know, but he did it for pennies, but at least he got like a bowl of rice at the end of the day or whatever. He eventually started to ask the cooks to teach him how to cook. They wouldn't. Why would you? So he had to bribe them. Look, I'll buy drinks tonight. So he spent his money buying them drinks, and they would eventually let him see what they were doing. And that's how he learned how to cook. And, you know, fast forward this many years later, you know, he had a business. It was feeding his family. You know, his kids were growing up. You know, he could support his family on his business. But it was so clear that he was so proud of his craft, that he had obviously learned the skills the hard way. and continue to personally refine and discover new techniques and find new techniques that he would use to, like, every time he wanted to make that skin just that bit lighter, that bit crispier, you know, refine his seasoning, all that stuff. He really took great pride in his craft. And I remember asking him, you know, now you've developed all these techniques, like, you've surpassed all the masters who taught you. You know, are you excited to see your son take it on and, you know, surpass you one day? And he was like, you're kidding me? Like, there's no way I would let my kid take over this business. You know what I mean? Like, I busted my ass so that he would get a college and get a real job, was basically his take. And look, that is not going to be an unfamiliar story to you, to me, to probably all of your listeners. Probably all of our parents have said that, or probably we're saying that about our kids right now. But to me, I was like, okay, I came here to learn how to roast a pig. And I walked away with this guy basically telling me the entire immigrant story in one sentence. I busted my ass so my kid would never have to do this. And so for me, that was always the gift, right? When someone shares their story with you, and when you have a gift, you have to cherish it. So as a writer, I felt like it was my job to take that moment and put it out in the world as, like, purely and cleanly and true to the spirit of that person as possible. So I would say that about myself as a writer. Like, I was always very, very careful of knowing that the stories are not your creations, they're not yours, they're someone else's. And so you're entrusted with them. And that means you owe it to that person to do right by them. So anyway, so I guess I would say that. Like, I would say that to writers today. The way you break in is different. The way you build your audience, the way you build your own platform, you build your own brand is different than how, you know, I did it, sort of by necessity, just because, you know, times change, technologies change, the industries change. But I think there's a fundamental truth in that lesson that I learned somewhere along the way. When you are writing, it is almost always you fulfilling the act of sharing someone else's story. Unless you purely write about yourself, in which case, you know, I hope you're a hell of a stylist.
But what about those emails that you sent out during your year at CIA that you think made the reader so engaged in the writing that you, what was the messaging? What was the things that you said that made people go, this is a talented writer?
You know, I don't know. I haven't read him in a long time. I mean, I think, you know, I think I love a good story. I love, you know, and it's funny because when I went to college, I majored in Asian studies and creative writing. But to be completely honest, like, Asian studies was like, the Asian studies department was kind of like having some trouble. There was an Asian languages and cultures department also that was like bigger and had more funding. So I think Asian studies were like, we just need more majors, made it very easy. No shade on the University of Michigan Asian studies department, but I was not a very serious student. So I was like, oh, that'll be easy. And I was also a creative writing major, which sort of similarly was like, you know, it wasn't in the English department, which was the bigger department. So I was like, oh, cool. I can make up stories a couple times a year and like call that my major. So it's ironic that I ended up being a writer and actually focusing, not entirely by any stretch, but a lot of my work on Asian culture, Asian cuisine, particularly my own sort of Cantonese, Chinese culture and cuisine. Because that was never the plan. The plan was like, I'm having fun in college, boy. Like, I'm good. but anyway, so I say that because I wasn't, I don't, I, I wasn't like formally trained in writing in the sense of like, oh, this is how you like analyze the structure of a story. And this is how you, you know, these are the building blocks, you know, like I,
yeah.
It was very intuitive for me. And I think it was intuitive only because I loved telling stories. I loved listening to stories, hearing stories. My best friends, all the way back in college are all amazing storytellers, amazing talkers. So I've always just gravitated towards those people and that experience of storytelling and like shooting the shit and just being funny and having friends who can, you know, sit there and talk to you for 10 minutes straight on a monologue and you just like can't tear yourself away from it, you know? So I think when I started writing these emails, it was kind of me trying to do that for other friends. And right. like, also it was like, again, remembering the time, all the intricacies of working in a restaurant, of being a chef, all the cultural bits of calling people, yes, chef, no chef. Like that stuff is all known now because mm-hmm. we've seen it in TVs and movie and books. And, but that was all, I felt like I was being let into a sort of secret society right. at that time. Right. So it's that, one of the things I will say about storytelling, oh, what makes for a really strong story is always like presenting something that looks familiar, but then there's an unexpected piece of it that allows you to go, oh, wait, there's a lot more here yeah. that I don't know about. You know what I mean? Like that's always a key thing when you're crafting a story. What's the moment that makes you go, oh, wow, I never thought about that before. And when I was living this life in culinary school, I was living that moment all the time. Wow, I never knew that there's basically three body types of fish in the ocean. And if you learn how to fillet those three body types of fish, you can fillet any fish in the entire ocean. Like that blew my mind. So I was writing. So that literally was one of the emails I wrote. Did you know, you know?
Yeah.
So I do think there's some piece of that where I, you know, I just always loved storytelling and the experience of hearing a story and then the experience of telling a story. And I actually will say that is one of the things that's hard about food writing, because a lot of people think the food is the story.
Right.
And the food is never a story because the food is an object, right? A story needs, you need motion, you need progression, you need,
characters.
You know, probably characters, you need yeah. tension, you need some kind of tension. And like a bowl of pho is not, there's no tension in a bowl of pho unless you start to ask the right questions of it, right? Why is this way? Why did the person cook this way? Who is the person that cooked yeah. it? For me, it always almost always goes back in some way to the people around the food. For others, it might be about the ingredients or about the setting or whatever. But
this episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak. Setting up the tension is important, vital.
Yeah.
You have a parallel story about what the master barbecue person was saying about his son, you know. We, as immigrant parents, work so hard to get you out of the kitchen, but you went back to Chinatown and your mother, you moved into Chinatown. Your mother was like, what are you doing? And she started crying. And
yeah.
What do you think draws us second generation kids to go back to these like sort of weird ethnic enclaves so we can discover these things about our past?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, just to clarify, I never lived in Chinatown, but I did work there for yeah. some years after I came out of culinary school. And funny enough, I didn't come work in the restaurant industry after I graduated from culinary school. I'm sorry, I worked there before I went to culinary school. I worked in Chinatown before I went to culinary school. And then when I came out of culinary school, I was still, it doesn't matter. Point is, I did spend a few years working in Chinatown. But in nonprofits, not in restaurants. You know, it's a great question, and I don't know how I would answer it for other people. For me, I would say some element of nostalgia, some element of, you know, I had this pretty classic childhood remembered story when I was, when we didn't grow up in the enclave. My parents worked in Chinatown. But I grew up in New Jersey. So my parents had to commute. And I grew up in a very like white suburb. So for me, I had all the stinky lunch stories and the, you know, not wanting people to hear me talk that weird, funny language stories. And I was lucky in that I didn't fully reject speaking Cantonese. I was the first son. So like I, you know, it's like the parents are always strictest on you, you know, like my little brother could be like, oh, sure, whatever. I'm just talking to my parents in English all the time. But for me, you know, they had, you know, they were not ready to let that slide yet. So I had to speak Cantonese to them. They did maintain the language in the home. So for me, I felt still this like deep connection to Cantonese culture, Cantonese language, Cantonese cuisine. But I felt very removed from it. You know, I only experienced it in the home. And now that I was no longer in the home, where was I going to get my fix? Or where was the side of me that, you know, is like, hey, I'm Canto. Like, where was that going to get refueled? And so that was part of it. Also part of it too was like my parents, you know, worked in Chinatown. They made their living there. I felt I owed something to the community. You know, my parents were in that community. They worked in that community. They made their living there. They were able to send me to college. You know, so wherever I am in the world, you know, I owe it to my parents, but I also owe it to that community. So that was another reason why I wanted to work in a nonprofit there. And we did like affordable housing, and we did like, you know, help people get like, we did lots of like different social services and help people, you know, sign up for benefits and, you know, what we called food stamps at the time, so on and so forth. And for me, there's always been this, I can be close enough to that community, but I almost never feel like I'm in it.
Yeah.
Again, because I didn't grow up there. I don't know that many people who live there, work there today. So if I go, I still always feel a little bit like a tourist. And so I'm always kind of struggling with that tension a little bit of feeling like these are my people, but I don't know if I'm their people. And not that I feel rejected, but just I don't know how to like grab it and hold on to it. And that was really, for me, very, very much highlighted when I had a kid. And my wife is Portuguese. So, you know, our kid speaks neither Portuguese nor Cantonese, which is, you know, and we both, you know, time's not over yet, but, you know, we both feel a certain kind of way about that. And for me, I was like just really, really highly aware of the fact that I don't know how to teach my kid Cantonese like by myself. The way I learned the language was because I lived in a home where that was the language in the home. And immersive. My kid, my kid doesn't live in that. And it wasn't just the home, it was aunties, uncles.
Yeah.
My parents sent me to Hong Kong to live with an auntie there for whole summers at a time, you know? So it was that immersive experience, but it wasn't like, we wouldn't call it an immersive experience. It was just our life. And our life was surrounded by Cantonese speaking people. And I live, you know, a short subway ride away from Chinatown, but my kid might as well be in a different universe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that was very highlighted to me, like that distance to this neighborhood, to this community, and in kind of a real way to my own culture, feels like it's really distant. And it's something that I actively, you know, am seeking how to sort of reconnect myself to.
We are like, there's so many parallels to, you know, all these second generation, whether you're coming from Hong Kong or Vietnam. And when I listen to your story, I think about what it, things I always say is like, we're like a copy of a copy. And when we're talking, when you ask me about authenticity on stage, mm-hmm, on a split mm-hmm. table, I get drawn to that question because what's authentic to us as second generation people mm-hmm. I want to hear your thoughts on authenticity, because I wanted to turn the tables on you at the on stage at the Splendid Table, but I want to hear your thoughts of this idea of authenticity.
Well, it's interesting because what I'm talking about, right, is it's could be interpreted as, oh, I want the more authentic culture, and I don't have the authentic culture. Like what I just spent like 20 minutes, you know, monologuing about whatever, like could be interpreted as that. And that, but I want to be clear. I'm glad you bring this up. Like, that's not what I mean. That's not how I think about it. Right. I do think to your point, like my culture is authentic in the sense that it's authentic to me, right? Like whatever part of my brain naturally speaks in Cantonese, whatever part of my brain naturally speaks in English, and whatever part of my brain, you know, like whatever, that's reflective of who I am and what my experiences are. So I don't think of things are greater than or lesser than, right? And authenticity it's one of these weird concepts where like we know what it means, it's useful, but like the second you start poking at it, like the whole house falls down, right? Like, okay, so say like someone comes into a restaurant, is this you know, is this bowl of wontons authentically Chinese? So, well, okay, I've eaten like literally like wonton soup out of a Campbell's can, right? Like you can probably say that's not authentically Chinese, right? It's okay, so there is some meaning there, right? But if you're like some customer, you come to a restaurant and you want to like turn your nose up at something because it's not authentic enough. Well, again, we know why that dynamic exists. We know why. And like, yeah, I'd rather eat wonton noodles in Hong Kong or in Chinatown than out of a Campbell's can. Like, so I can't lie and say the word authentic doesn't mean anything to me. But when we say authentic, what do you even mean? Like, do you mean it's these wontons are served the way they're served in Hong Kong? Okay, sure. But do you mean are they served in Hong Kong in 2024? Mm-hmm. Or the way they were served in Hong Kong in 1992? Or the way they were served in Hong Kong in 1949? What do you mean? What's authentic? Because you got to give me a time if you're going to be a place. And if you're going to do that, then you got to give me like, well, if it's just the country, because no one say Hong Kong, they would think, oh, is it authentic to like China, right? Like, well, the wontons in Hong Kong are pretty different than the Hong Kongs in Shanghai, and let alone all the villages in between, let alone all the cooks in between. You know what I mean? So like right away, when you start poking holes in the holes, and not even poking holes, just like put your finger leaning on the on the door of the authenticity house, the whole thing falls apart really fast. So it's weird because it's like, it both means something. We can't deny that it means something, but it means also absolutely nothing.
Yeah. And that's a construct of culture, right? I mean, that's in a nutshell what you just explained. It's that I'm always on this quest for like, what is Vietnamese? What do we define? And the more you ask that, the more it falls apart, that there's no argument to any of it because there's so much derivative sort of elements that come from so many parts of the world today, 50 years after the war and, you know, Vietnam's war, it's gone. And now there's like a new evolution, a new way of being Vietnamese or being somebody as a descendant of Hong Kong. It's all over the place now. But that leads me to the next sort of idea as somebody sitting in your seat, thinking about white American chefs, Latinx chefs doing Asian food, and we see them get crucified and bashed. But where do we draw the line with that kind of like thinking?
Yeah, you know, I get it, man. Like, especially as someone, like, look, there are some quotes that always stand out in my mind, right? Like Eddie Huang, you know, he's like, he's out of the sort of food world. He's moved beyond, he's transcended. But I totally remember, like, when he was a young restaurateur, and I remember he had this great quote where he was like, I had to hide my food from you my whole fucking life. And all of a sudden, like, you did your like 1 year working for Bear Stearns in Shanghai, and you want to come back and tell me what authentic Chinese food is? Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there is definitely that vibe, and I get it. And there, you know, a lot of people have to like work through their feelings of like, you know, being othered and being ostracized. And so that's like one point, you know, to keep in mind, right? Another point to keep in mind is, yeah, there's like rampant cultural appropriation all the time. And sometimes it is like incredibly frustrating and unjust that, you know, people who look like the people who made fun of you your whole life,
yeah,
for your culture, for your cuisine, for your stinky food, now love it, fetishize it, exoticize it, and then go on and like sell it. So now they're getting rich off the stuff that you made. Like, I 1000% get why that is infuriating and intolerable. At the same time, it's like, so I hold that in my head,
yeah,
very firmly. I also hold in my head the fact that like cuisine has always evolved through many factors, but none bigger than when different cultures come into contact with one another. Maybe it's friendly contact, trade, or just like peaceful coexistence happens less often than you'd like. Or it's violent conflict, you know, violent contact, colonization, you know, war, other forms of conflict, anywhere in between, right? Like, cuisine has always evolved because people have looked at someone else's food and said, that looks good, I'm going to try to make it, and maybe I won't make it exactly the way they do. I'm going to make it my way, whether on purpose or because I didn't have the right ingredients, but whatever. You know, like, and that's how stuff has always changed on the plate. So that's another thing I hold in my head. And the third thing I hold in my head too is like, I don't know, maybe I'm biased because I have friends who have done this, but like, I have multiple friends who are white Americans who moved to Thailand, lived in Thailand, just as an example, completely fallen in love with it, and have like really spent decades, literal decades, putting in the work,
yeah,
learning the language, learning the craft, and, you know, in some way selling it back to America, right? Like, true. Whether it be in the form of media and stories, or in the form of restaurants, you know, physically selling food, true. But like, I've just never been able to find a reason why that's not okay.
Yeah.
And there are I think because there are ways of doing that in a way that's okay, and there's ways of doing that are not okay, right? Like, hey, I went there and had a great vacation once, and I bought a couple of cookbooks, come to my $115 tasting menu for, you know, authentic, you know, my spin on authentic Thai food that's way better than the Thai food you get, you know, at that $4.95 place. You know, I would say that's the way that doesn't feel okay to me. But you put in the work, you appreciate it, you want to, and you like, and hell, even better, if you're helping the platform, in this case, like Thai cooks, Thai restaurateurs, when, you know, the media come to you because you speak English without an accent, and you use that time to put on the folks who've inspired you, like, I feel like that's pretty cool. So I know I may have gotten very far away from your question at
No,
this point, but
it's clear. I mean, there's clarity because there's nuance, and you really get into the nuance of sort of the whole spectrum. I don't mean to put you on the spot right now, but I'm going to ask this question. And if you don't know, then just feel free to say, you know, you don't. Do you pay attention to any rising Vietnamese chefs in the food space right now? Like I said, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm curious from your position if you are watching any of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I, you know, naming names off the top of my head is tricky.
Yeah.
But Helen at Saigon Social in New York, I think is amazing. You know, I never got to, I've been to Porridge and Puff, but I never got to Phenakite. But I think Min is amazing. I mean, I just love hearing her talk. I love talking to her. And like my meal at Porridge and Puff was awesome, awesome.
Yeah.
God, there's so many. There's actually this really cool moment in Vietnamese food in New York City where I live right now. And that's where I'm mostly familiar. I've eaten many meals at Dian D, which I like a lot. In LA, totally biased because she was my friend before she was a chef. But Win Lay.
Win Lay.
Do you know Win?
Yeah, yeah. They every name that you've mentioned have been on the podcast.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. it's great. It's awesome to hear that there's recognition in the bigger picture that, you know, because I look up to these chefs and you know the crazy thing is,
oh God, because Vietnamese food rules. Like
the chefs that you mentioned, and you and another person, he's the founder of Song Khai Jin's, everybody has a thread of some social work. You know, Inle has a lot of time. She spent a lot of time in the Gulf.
That's how we know each other. Actually, oh. from both of our past lives. Yeah, when we both worked in social justice.
Yeah, and it's almost like, you know, when you were talking about in the earlier part of the episode where you were talking about your work in Chinatown, it reminded me of Inle. I was going to bring her up, and Song Khai Jin's founder Daniel, all spent time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the Gulf or in social work, and are highly reflecting the journey that they spent, you know, in some cases, you know, half a decade or a decade before they each got to the food space. So, and now hearing about your work in the social work space, there's got to be some link to that. It's in order to kind of have this sort of robust viewpoint of food, it helps to have this weird kind of connection to the people on the ground somehow.
You know, it's funny because I wouldn't say it's causal, certainly like correlated, that I think it's exactly that. It's like just this innate sense that like you really care about people.
Yeah.
Like you care about people, and not just in the abstract, you know, the idea of caring about people, but like you really want to know that you can do something in your life that positively affects another person. You know, tracks very closely with the idea that you want to know their stories, you want to tell their stories, you want to help them share their stories. In my case, or you know, when I remember I saw Wynn recently. And, you know, we hadn't really seen each other actually since she went on her culinary journey and became a chef and opened her little takeout restaurant in LA, Bay-E, am I pronouncing it right?
Oh, yeah.
Bay-E. Mm-hmm. Super tasty. And I totally talked to her about it. I'm like, oh, how did you go from, you know, when we were, so we met each other in the Gulf Coast of Mississippi in this city called Biloxi, Mississippi. It's about an hour, not quite an hour and a half east of New Orleans. It was totally decimated in Hurricane Katrina. And I'm sure all your listeners know the Gulf Coast is, you know, one of the sort of great population centers of Vietnamese Americans. So she went there with a number of other like Vietnamese community organizers and organizing groups. And I met her there because I was also doing post-Rotuna relief and recovery and then rebuilding work. And, you know, she kind of drew this straight line from like, she went there, she was there, she was there quite young, I think out of college, but really, you know, wanted to go in deeper and went to grad school. And after grad school, like was very, you know, got very involved in labor unions and worked in labor unions. And like for her, the reason she turned to cooking was because she also needed to have a comfort for herself, cooked food that, like, you know, it's hard work and it's a lot of times like really like emotionally draining and distressing work. So as a way to sort of comfort herself, you know, she would cook food and really loved cooking, really loved, you know, the food she grew up with. I just felt like, you know, this is another way that I want to bring positivity and comfort and joy to other people's lives. Like, so I think in her mind, it's actually the two, like the very different kinds of work. I don't think she's conflating the two, but I think the impulse is the same. Like, here's a person that's like deeply committed to giving a sense of comfort to other people.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese-American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. And if you kind of think about a lot of the people that are doing film or food or these kind of creative experiences, you could see there's roots. For example, the director Bao Nguyen, he just directed Greatest Night in Pop. You know, he was really in the Obama campaign when President Obama was coming out of, you know, he's running, and his social justice roots seem to have come out of those, the time that he spent on the campaign, you know, going door to door, trying to get people to sign up. And when you watch his body of work, whether it's Be Water or Greatest Night in Pop, you see this tie, these ties back to the social work, the social justice sort of. And I'm getting this feeling from you that if you don't sort of have that love for humanity, it's hard to look for the stories. It's hard to be connected to people.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, I don't know if
it's not causal.
I don't know that it's causal, but I do think that's right. And I think that there's also this, I mean, there are ways to do it too, you know, that's like exploitative, right? So for sure. Like, but I think the impulse to want to hear someone's story, yes, for some people can be voyeuristic and exploitative. But I think for some of the folks you're talking about, and I'd include myself in this, it really comes out of a sense that people are wonderful. You know, it's as simple as that. People are wonderful. You know, I had this really great revelation once. I don't even remember when. I just remember this thought popping in my head, and it's never left. You go through your day, you're walking down the street. How many people do you see? Like, it could literally be
hundreds,
maybe thousands, right? Like every time I get on a subway car, that's probably a couple hundred people, right? So I will go through my day and be able to see thousands of people. And they mean nothing to me in the sense that, like, I don't know them, they don't know me, I'm just trying to get to the next station, whatever, whatever. Fine. That's how we all, literally how you have to be in the world. You got places to be. They're extras in your movie, right? But if you stop for even 1 second and think about, everyone of those extras has their own movie. right? You're the extra in their movie. So the all the stories you contain, all the stories you want to tell people about your life, you've seen, you've experienced, all the thoughts you've had, all the brilliant ones, all the stupid ones, whatever. That guy next to you on the train has the same thing. And that's like incredible to think about. You know what I mean? Like the richness of that is just infinite. Yeah, so like that was a realization where I was just like, it just let me marvel at the fact that no matter how important you are to yourself, you know, there is someone who has the same depth right next to you, and you might never even get it. You probably won't ever get it, and that's okay. But there are so many chances for you to tap into someone else's story, into someone else's life, if you do it in a way that makes them feel like they should trust you with it.
That's a beautiful reflection. I want to ask you, in your journey in the last 15 years, you've gathered a lot of interesting stories that have led to some sort of reflection the way you just shared it. What are some of the most powerful memories of the work that you've been a part of in the last 15 years?
Oh man, there's so much. You know, certainly telling Jackie Wong's The Cantonese Barbecue Master story that I referenced. And, you know, now I think of the guy that I wrote that story probably, you know, 15 years ago, to your point. Certainly, actually more than 15 years, because the magazine closed 15 years ago. So, so like 16, 17 years ago.
Yeah.
A lot, certainly a lot of stories that I've had the privilege to tell, but also like we haven't talked on this conversation about my work as an editor, really. And so I'm an editor at a publisher. I work mostly on cookbooks, not exclusively on cookbooks. I'm actually editor in chief of the imprint, but I still have my own books, and I came up through the years as an editor working with authors. And you know, when you get to work on someone's book with them, it's sort of that same thing, right? Like it's that same thing of being entrusted with their story, right? And it's so important to them that it come out the way that they want. It's so important to them. And so I take that seriously. I take that as an honor. I take that as a privilege. And then like the great thing too about being an editor versus being a writer is when the book comes out, you don't have to feel like, oh, now I gotta go sell this.
Yeah.
You know, now I go flog it. You can just be a fan of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's something really pure about this thing where like, you contribute in the way you can. You help the author achieve their vision. My style of editing is I never want the, I think I'm a pretty good writer, right? Like I said, I'm not like the most amazing writer, but I think I'm a pretty good writer. I have a strong sense of my own voice. I never want someone's book to sound like I wrote it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, that's never, ever my intention. Like I don't want to rewrite anything. I don't want to write anything. I want you to write your book. I want to help guide you to write the book that you're trying to write. So you make the story what the story wants to be. And when that works, and you see the pride that the author has, it's incredible. It's incredible.
Wow. I always expect.
I worked on Sheldon Simeon's book. And he did this a beautiful thing. He did this beautiful thing when the book came out. He asked for one more meeting. Where the whole team, me, his co-writer, the photographer, the designer on our team who worked on the book, the people who did the publicity and marketing who worked on the book, his agent, he asked for one meeting with the whole team just so he could say thank you to all of us. And it was such a beautiful moment. And like I just think of that, you know, times however many, you know, like the gratitude people will feel when you help them tell their story, or when you're just a piece of them telling your story for the process. I think of this really wonderful author. I always pronounce her name Hannah Che, C-H-E. She only finally corrected me after I've known her for like years. She pronounces it Chuh. But she wrote this book called The Vegan Chinese Kitchen, which is this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous book. Wonderful story. She became a vegan in college, came home, you know, environment, animal rights, the whole thing. Came home to her Chinese family and, you know, was trying to sell them on veganism. And I kind of like not buying it, but it's, you know, fine, whatever. Like, you know, a lot of what they ate was, you know, sort of by nature vegan at home anyway, the stir fried greens and right. tofu dishes and all that. But then one day it was like New Year, like Lunar New Year, and the family was making dumplings. And she wasn't helping because they were pork. And her dad just turned to her and just said, "Oh, you're not going to do this with us?" And it was a sudden, this like sudden realization. It's like, oh my God, am I turning my back on my family? Am I turning my back on my culture? You know, because of my diet.
Yeah.
And so it caused her to sort of start diving into vegan, vegetarian food in Chinese cuisine, which actually has this tremendous, I'm sure in Vietnamese as well, like, you know, all the Buddhist temple traditions and cuisines, which are amazing, like totally delicious. But I have not seen anyone write a book on this in English, literally since 1991 or 92. Like Eileen Yin Fei Lo wrote a book called The Good Earth. Rest in peace, Eileen. But like in the early 90s, I'm sure it sold like 9 copies. Like who could have possibly wanted to buy the vegetarian Chinese cookbook in 1991? But Hannah went to China, went to the only vegetarian culinary school, and like professional vegetarian culinary school in the entire country, has traveled and researched, and she wrote this amazing book. And you know, she was, I don't know what, I'm not trying to infantilize it, but she was like this kid, you know, she was like a couple years out of college, who was actually didn't mean to be a writer. She actually studied piano. She's an amazing piano player. Like she was a concert pianist, but like just fell into this passion. And you know, I'm sitting there watching her go up and take home a James Beard Award for it. And you know, just the pride, like I'm like welling up thinking about it right now. Like I think she's like my little sister. I'm like, could be her dad. I'm like 20 years older than her. But like I just think of the pride of being a part of that story. It's extraordinary. Like being an editor is the best. It's like you get to be, you know, you get to be like the doctor in the delivery room. you know, it's amazing.
You brought up the editor stuff, and I was expecting more from the podcast or the Splendid Table, but that shows me sort of where your passion is in life. It's, you know, helping writers and getting their voice out and getting it heard. And I think there's parallels within the podcast space.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Oops, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have that much to say about it, except that, yeah, that's exactly right. And I approach like interviewing people, you know, the same way I approach them interviewing for a story. It's like the opportunity to whether it's because I have access to the platform or because, you know, I can ask someone a question that helps them think about something in a different way, or, you know, for whatever the reason, you know, giving people, again, just being a part of that storytelling process is a great, you know, that's like, that is like my entire professional love. So whatever medium it happens in, whether it be a story I'm writing or a story or a book I'm editing, or, you know, directly talking to someone in front of a microphone, in some ways, it's totally different kinds of work, totally different media, but like in some ways, it's all the same thing to me.
Francis, I want to thank you, first of all, for coming on the podcast. But beyond that, I want to thank you for the decades of work that you've done to elevate all of us in the mainstream, whether it's through food or your work at the podcast at Splendid Table. You know, I feel very honored to have you on my podcast today. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, thanks so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Francis.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.